Okay, so I'd like to welcome everybody to the launch of the LCC Policy Forum seminar series with Andrew Gilligan and Danny Williams. And I'm Rachel Aldred, I'm the chair of the forum. And just before anything else, I'd just like to start by observing a minute's silence for the cyclist who was killed this morning in central London. So please make sure your mobiles are off. Now, I know we've got a lot to discuss this evening, so I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I just wanted to say three things very quickly, to introduce myself, to say something about the LCC Policy Forum, and also to make a few very quick general observations about the context. So I'm Rachel Aldred, and I'm a senior lecturer here at Westminster University, and I'd like to thank Westminster for providing the room, as well as people from LCC for helping out and ticking off the names and helping organise the room. I've got a number of cycling-related hats, so I've done research in cycling for a number of years, and I also lead the MSC Transport Planning and Management here, which, as you might imagine, has a lot of cycling-related stuff in it. But more importantly for tonight, I'm chair of the LCC Policy Forum. I was elected to the LCC board towards the end of last year, and I've been chairing the Policy Forum since January. So the Policy Forum has 9 elected members, and it meets quarterly with a remit to develop LCC's policy positions in a range of areas. And we very much welcome input. Any LCC member can attend the quarterly meetings. We have around about 20, 25 people come usually. So we deal with quite a range of different issues. At the moment we're doing work, for example, on cycling infrastructure and design. So we've developed a matrix that translates some of the Love London Go Dutch principles to evaluating pieces of cycling infrastructure, proposed new routes. We're also trying to develop guidance for thresholds of motor vehicle traffic, motor vehicle speeds, at which cyclists shouldn't be expected to share with motor vehicles. So we're doing some work in that area. We're also doing work on motor vehicle offences, moving vehicle offences and traffic enforcement, and also inclusive cycling, cycling for all. So we deal with a range of different areas, and we always welcome expertise and input. So please have a look at the LCC website or contact me if you're interested. Also, we're organising these regular seminars, and this is the launch event with Danny Williams and Andrew Gilligan. So we've also got a whole range of other seminars that will follow on. So there are going to be regular events, and if people signed up to receive more information, I'll send it round. But I just wanted to mention a few of the things that we've got coming up. So on the 2nd of May, we're going to be hosting a workshop on modelling tipping points for transformations in cycling in London with James Woodcock from CEDA. And Alex McMillan from UCL. So that's going to be looking at how tipping points in cycling could take place. What would we be looking for? How would this happen? Then towards the end of May, on the 28th, we've got Till Cochlin, who's a researcher at Lund University in Sweden, who's going to be presenting some results of a survey on cycling experiences in Copenhagen and Stockholm. So hopefully that'll have some lessons for us here in London. Then on the 6th of June, we're having a workshop on campaigning priorities for LCC in 2014. So looking at different types of local campaign, looking at policy themes, with a range of different speakers. So topics will include safe routes to school, for example, permeability improvements. Then in July, we're looking at land use in outer London, how even development could be used to promote cycling. So there's going to be a lot more detail about those events, but I just wanted to give you a flavour of some of the things that the Policy Forum is doing. And those seminars will be open to the public and will be in central London. But finally, I just wanted to make a couple of brief observations about where we are, because I couldn't resist saying something about where we are, the current situation in terms of cycling. Because I've been studying cycling for a few years now, but my background is sociology and social policy, so I'm not coming from a transport planning or engineering background. But I find that really interesting, because a lot of the debates, a lot of the arguments, they have similarities with other policy areas. So often debates are around, for example, redistribution. They're around inequality. They're around social justice. And they're around recognition and marginalisation of different groups. So I see these things, as many of us have, happening in cycling. But there's a lot of debates around these things in other policy areas. So I see similarities there. But a lot of arguments are also around the responsibility of the individual and the responsibility of the state. And this is where I think, in London, we're starting to see a really profound change taking place, which, from an academic point of view, is quite exciting, as well as from the perspective of cycling. So what I think is important is that cycling is beginning to be seen as a system or as a service rather than as an individual lifestyle choice. It's a really profound shift, I think, although obviously there's a lot of barriers, there's a lot of problems still in the way. So for the past 20 years, really, in this country, people have been told that cycling is an individual decision. It's a decision that's good for you. You know, it's the right thing to do. But it's something that ultimately is the responsibility of the individual. So we've been told that, you know, cycling is cheap. Cycling is environmentally friendly. And my own personal favourite, that cyclists have the body of somebody 20 years younger. And we know all these things are true, of course. But somehow, it hasn't made a difference on a national level. Somehow, people are not all taking up cycling when you look at the census. You know, on a national level, we're not seeing changes. By contrast, in London and a few other places, we are starting to see change, and I think some really important change. In that, you know, cycling is starting to be seen as part of the mainstream transport system, and the money is starting to get serious. So, you know, there's still a lot of barriers, there's still a lot of problems, but for me, it's a real shift, and it's one that hopefully is going to continue. And the other thing I just wanted to say was that obviously this shift hasn't just happened. This shift has been largely thanks to the work of a lot of dedicated individuals in many organisations and in no organisations. So many of the people here tonight, I would say, are part of this and, you know, have contributed greatly to it. And I just wanted to quote from Margaret Mead, the social anthropologist, who said, "Never doubt that a small group of committed people can change the world. In fact, it's the only thing that ever has." And I think that has a lot of relevance to cycling, I believe. And that leads me on quite nicely to introducing our chair for tonight, who is Danny Williams from LCC in the City of London and of the Cyclists in the City blog. And I'm sure many of us here are familiar with Danny's blog. And I think Danny's contribution has been really important. His blog has been thoughtful, well-argued, well-researched, and the use of data in particular has been particularly useful, particularly important. So, for example, his use of the streamline counts. When you see those figures showing that cyclists make up such a large proportion and a growing proportion of traffic over central London bridges, I think that has a really profound impact. And illustrating the continuing modal shift in London away from the car towards buses, towards cycling, has also been very important, because it's helped to create, with my sociology hat on, a narrative that we're winning, that we're on the winning side, which I think is important. This could be our motorway age, really. If you look back to the 1950s, to the coming of the motorways were not planning for existing drivers. The motorways were visionary. They were planning for the future, a future that would be very different. They symbolise the hope of a new age. And in my more optimistic moments, I would like to think that that is us today. So that leads on really nicely to saying, please could you welcome Danny Williams, who's going to chair the event and introduce our speaker, Andrew Gillingham. Thank you.
Hello. It's very good to see you all here. I'm very sorry if my voice is a bit croaky, but I hope I'm projecting myself to the back of the room. To some extent, Andrew doesn't really need much introducing. I think you all know who he is and what he does, at least in his capacity as cycling commissioner. I think 2 years ago, none of us would have expected London to have a cycling commissioner. The simple fact that he's here at all is pretty impressive. So, quite pleased to see you here. Thank you very much. Some of you may also remember that several years ago, a significant newspaper, that newspaper being the Evening Standard, ran a campaign about cycling safety. People who are more recently involved in cycle campaigning, like myself, probably more familiar with things in the Times, but it's worth remembering that Andrew was the guy who introduced the concept of campaigning in the newspapers, 6 years ago? 7 years ago? And you should remember that when he talked to you. I'm not going to talk for long at all. The format of tonight really is for Andrew to talk to us and for you to have a chance to engage with him. Some people have submitted questions in advance. I have a few pet questions of my own that I hope you'll allow me to sneak in. So what we'll do is we'll have Andrew present for a bit. I'll come in with a few questions. We'll open it up to the floor. And then I may come in with a few more questions that were submitted earlier, as I know people want to hear Andrew's thoughts on those points. So I'll shut up, because you're not really here to listen to me, and pass on to Andrew.
Thank you. First thing to say is that the cycling vision we announced a month ago isn't really just for you. It's not for people who cycle now. It's not for people who are committed cyclists. It is for you, of course, and it will improve your cycling lives. But just as much, perhaps even more, it is for people who would like to cycle now but feel unable to. We want to give those people the confidence to cycle. We want to use them to change the nature of cycling in London. In the mayor's words, we want to de-lycrify it. We want to make it normal. We want to broaden cycling. We want to broaden the age range. We want to broaden the gender range. We want to broaden the social mix, which is quite upmarket at the moment. And the way we are going to do that, we're providing a whole set of new routes, which hopefully will appeal to a broader range of people than cycle now. And the other group of people it is for everyone, because this will benefit everyone, even if they have never gotten a bike and they have no intention of getting on a bike. And that is one of the key ways in which I and others have sold this to the mayor, and we are selling it to the huge number of stakeholders which we had to persuade to make this happen. More cycling is good for everyone. It means fewer cars on the road, it means less air pollution, it means less competition for a parking space if you're a resident of Kensington and Chelsea who never wants to go on a bike in their life. It means fewer people on the tube, less competition for a seat on the tube. So it is good for everyone. It means better places for everyone. It means somewhere to sit and eat a sandwich, that kind of thing. It's not all about segregation. There is no one-size-fits-all approach. There will be more segregation, but the majority of the network is going to be unsegregated. In some places it's going to be about permeability, worked very well in Hackney. In some places it's two ways and one-way streets, it's quite simple. In some places it's just about guiding people better through the great potential routes that already exist. And it's also as much about perceptions as about actual physical stuff on the ground. The physical stuff on the ground, we're doing, as you know, a big, long, we stand to be corrected on Twitter, but we think the longest continuous, substantially segregated urban cycle route in Europe, from West London all the way to Barking, about 15 miles at least, possibly up to 20, 15 miles, depending on how far west we can start it on the A40. And we're doing some big high-profile schemes like that, and part of the purpose of those things is to give people all over London the confidence that we are interested in them and we are going to make life better for them. But there won't be huge high-profile schemes like that absolutely everywhere. There will be routes everywhere. We're going to do three main types of routes, as you know. The superhighways, they're all going to be upgraded. Some of them are going to be moved, some of the existing ones and some of the proposed ones. Then there are the quiet ways, which are good low traffic routes, essentially the London cycle network done properly. They'll be delivered end to end, not piecemeal. They'll be continuously signposted. It will be impossible to lose your way. They won't give up at the difficult places like some of the LCN Plus routes do now. We're calling them quiet ways. And then in the middle, there'll be what we're calling the Central London Grid to join it all together. And that's one of the other key principles. It's got to join together. Because, again, most cycle routes do nothing of the sort at the moment. One of the most important things we are doing is making the routes line up with people's mental maps of London. And, of course, the most common map that people carry in their heads is the tube map. So a lot of these routes, not all of them, are going to be named after and run in rough parallel to tube lines. We're going to have the Circle Line Quiet Way, for instance, going to run just parallel to this building. We're going to have the Jubilee Line Quiet Way running on Quiet Street all the way down, probably from Wembley to Baker Street. And when you get to Baker Street, you'll be able to change into the Circle Line Quiet Way to get yourself to King's Cross. People will know where those go. Everyone knows where the Jubilee Line goes. Everyone in northwest London, anywhere knows where it goes. Everyone in this part of London knows where the Circle Line goes. Sometimes they'll be named after bus routes where there's no tube lines. They won't pass exactly every single place, but they'll pass close. Where we are going to segregate, it's a reallocation of road space to reflect, as Rachel said, what is already happening in London. In inner and central London, we are moving towards a post-car city. We've already seen enormous reductions in the number of people owning cars. in central and in London. There isn't a single zone one or two borough where more than half the households have a car, and that's the households. If you think about people, it's even fewer. In Kensington and Chelsea, the number of households owning a car has gone down from 49% in 2001 to 44% in 2011. In Westminster, only 35%, I think, of households own a car, in the 30s. In Hackney, only 33% of households own a car. And yet the road system is designed for this, you know, what becoming a slightly minority form of transport. So what we're doing is simply reallocating space to reflect what's actually happening in people's travelling lives and people's travelling patterns. We've been used to thinking small. We've been used to thinking apologetic. I sometimes think that the main thing any cycle route planner needs is about 50 cyclist dismount signs and a lot of white paint to put on pavements. We've been used to thinking you can do anything so long as it doesn't disturb the existing environment and the existing streetscape in any way. So that's why you get all these you know, pictures of bicycles painted on roads and all these you know, white lines painted on pavements and all that kind of nonsense. We're moving away from that. We're going to be ambitious, we're going to think bigger. And obviously one of the things we're doing is we are taking over a lane of the Westway flyover on the between Wood Lane and Ranelagh Bridge, probably. And that's a good example of why we can do that, because traffic on that flyover has fallen by 22% in the last 10 years. Everywhere you look in central London, the story is the same. Massive falls in road traffic, which give us the opportunity to do this and to bring about further falls. Like Danny and Rachel have said, bike traffic, what we've seen is a huge fall in car traffic. We've also seen a huge rise in bike traffic. Bike traffic across London Bridge, for instance, has increased by more than 200% over the same period as traffic on the Westway has fallen by 22%. Traffic on the Victoria Embankment, another part of the bike cross rail we're doing, that's fallen by 31% on the central section. Traffic on Upper Thames Street has fallen by 40% in the last 10 years. So we know what we're going to do. A lot of people seem to be quite pleased with the vision. I'm very happy with how it's gone down. But the next part is delivery. The fact is that we do not own 95% of the roads. We own the Westway, we own the Victoria Embankment, but we don't own the vast majority of the roads that these routes will run on. So almost the key part of my job is to work with the boroughs, the people who do own the roads. That is why, apart from a few routes on our roads, there aren't any specific routes given in our document, because we have to agree them with the boroughs first. We are very pleased. I go so far as to say I'm thrilled with how the boroughs have responded to all this. I've personally spoken to the leaders of portfolio holders in all the Zone 1 boroughs, and most of the Zone 2, and increasing numbers of the outer boroughs as well. Without exception, actually with one exception, of all political shades, they have been receptive. And I don't know if you saw our press release when we launched the vision, included a quote from the leader of Westminster Council, Tory-controlled, of course, and included a quote from the leader of Camden Council, Labour-controlled. It's not actually the what that we need to talk to them about, really. It's the how. What they want is to be involved from the beginning and to help take part in designing the network. And that is what is going to happen. One of the things you've got to remember, though, is that local government is a tanker. It takes time to turn. In the next 6 to 12 months, you will see, I hope, the first signs of the real change we're bringing about. The extension of CS2 to Stratford, which everybody seems to like. It includes, of course, floating bus stops, segregated lanes for cyclists, a much improved CS5, Cycle Superhighway 5. That's the one that goes from Victoria to New Cross. Itself, the designs we've published for consultation last year, already an improvement on the previous designs, are going to be further improved. And I think most people will like that as well. It won't be perfect, but it'll be quite good. Some real changes starting to happen in the next 6 months at a few junctions that people particularly didn't like. We have cancelled a couple of schemes that came out of the junction review that really weren't any good. The Mile End Road, Burdett Road junction. I think you'll like the schemes we're coming up with for that. They're not finalised yet, but I think you'll like them when you see them. The Lambeth Bridge roundabout, we've cancelled that. And on the junction review generally, we are massively refocusing it. We were going to be doing 35 junctions in the first year. It's far too many to do a serious job, really, with a fairly small amount of money, £19 million. And we are now going to massively refocus that, go drill down on a far smaller number of junctions, done far more thoroughly and far more effectively. That's the idea. So you'll see change in the next 6 to 12 months, but you also see, I think, some less good legacy schemes which date back from before we changed the policy. These schemes might be opening after the vision was published, but they were designed and approved before the vision, before I got there, and they will not be fully consistent with it. The entire 2013-14 LIP programme, for instance. LIPs are London Local Implementation Plans. These are our core delivery mechanism with the boroughs. The entire 2013-14 LIP programme was approved in December last year and essentially reflects the pre-vision policy. So don't go beating us up if there are things this year that don't look consistent with the vision. In terms of the LIPs, 2014 is the first year when we will be able to make, and you will see, significant change. Equally, you will see some planning schemes which really aren't good enough at the moment. The Olympic Park will reopen partly in July. It's just not very good at the moment, I'm afraid. We are going to, again, that is a legacy of a planning consent that was granted in 2007, and before the current mayor took office, but certainly before the policy was changed. So again, there will be justified complaints about cycling provision in the Olympic Park. It's not good enough at the moment. We are working to upgrade it and to improve it, because I was extremely disappointed when I saw the plans. And in fact, I've got meetings this week to get going on how we make it better. So you'll see legacy schemes like that. King's Cross is another one. That's another scheme that was given permission before the policy changed. So remember, local government is a tanker, takes time to turn. But I think it is turning. I sense, as Rachel said, a real political shift. I sense real willingness, real receptiveness, even in places which you might not think would be willing and receptive to change. But we've got to keep the pressure up. One of the most important things you can help with is doing that, is helping us persuade the boroughs, is keeping the pressure up on them to genuinely get cycling. My slight worry is that they're all fine about everything in principle, and then of course when we come down to the practicalities, can we move this parking spot or cut down this tree or something, they're all going to come up with all sorts of objections, even the better ones. So pressure will need to be maintained. We're just getting started on those kind of dull, granular, but very necessary discussions with the boroughs about individual schemes, which you need to have. I'll tell you a little bit about the delivery programme. This is a boring bit, but this is how we're going to do it. First, I've given CFL a list of 8 priorities. They're all quite boring and administrative, okay, but I'll go through them. Firstly, we've got to establish consistency and clarity in our decision making, which we've done pretty much. Secondly, we've got to understand what we're doing already, make sure it's consistent with the vision. Thirdly, we've got to stop doing things which are not in the vision. Fourthly, we're going to decide what the new routes will be like, and one of the key things here is the London Cycle Design Standards, which you, as you know, are already up for revision, the revisions at the moment aren't good enough. They're going to have to change and to be more radical to be in line with the vision, and that's one of the key pieces of work I'm doing now. I want to make sure that when we publish the new London Cycle Design Standards, which we're going to do in the summer, I hope, that they are A, fully consistent with the vision, and then everything we do is fully consistent with them. I want to make them the template for what you've got to do if you want our funding. And there are all sorts of things. I mean, as you know, at the moment, a huge amount of what is supposedly done for cyclists is not always particularly good, to put it diplomatically. One of the ways we are going to change that is we're going to say, look, you know, these are the new standards, and if you want our money, you've got to follow them. I think the London Design Standards can be flexible. I think people will be willing to accept, as they already do accept, short stretches of unavoidable inadequacy on generally adequate routes. They shouldn't mandate a one-size-fits-all approach, but they do have to be better. And, you know, they don't have to be designed from the bottom up either. I mean, we don't have to kind of, you know, design them from scratch ourselves. I'm perfectly willing to pinch good ideas from other comparable places. There's quite good ones in Dublin, for instance, if only they were followed. So that the LCDS are really important. That's a key part of what we're going to be doing in the next few months. Okay, fifth thing we're doing is obviously deciding whether the new routes will be. Because of the need to understand and manage the wider network impacts, the whole cycle network in central and inner London at least is going to be agreed between us and the boroughs at an early stage. On the central London grid, we have established a grid programme board. I'm sorry if this is too boring and bureaucratic, stop me if it is. We've established a grid programme board and it's going to be chaired by Mark Chetwynd at Kensington and Chelsea. I'm a member, and there's going to be a senior level representative from every central London borough and the Royal Parks. And all the top people from each borough, so in the city it's Ian Simmons, in Westminster it's Martin Lowe, they will be on that board, and that's all make decisions about the routes. We've had the first meeting of that already, and that's where we'll decide the routes. And I hope we will have that process done relatively quickly so we can get started on it. I want the majority of the grid to be in place by 2060. On superhighways, as I mentioned, we're going to change some, reroute some, and to cancel some as well. They're going to be the same number, but they're not all going to be in the same places. Again, I can't be too specific about what I'm going to do on those yet, because they need to be, again, agreed with the boroughs. One of the key ways to screw anything, to be honest, is to announce it in public before you've agreed it with the stakeholders. I'm not going to tell you where the new routes are going to be, and I'm not going to tell you how they're going to change. I will tell you as soon as I can, as soon as I've agreed it with all the relevant stakeholders. But rest assured, we are going to change quite a few of them. And then we're going to upgrade. Basically, the reason we're changing them is that some of the routes, some of the ones at the moment, simply aren't capable of being upgraded to the standards we set out on the routes that they follow. And the same goes for some of the proposed ones. We can't possibly hope to achieve adequate standards on some of the roads we're doing. So we're going to change the routes. In other cases, we can hope to achieve adequate standards on the existing routes, and we're doing it. So that's where we're at on the superhighways. On the quiet ways, we are going to get the first one of those in place next year, early next year, I hope. We are going to do quite a lot of work on orbital cycle superhighways, orbital quiet ways, as well as radial ones. That's going to be the main focus of our orbital work. We're going to do a quiet way, for instance, parallel to the South Circular across South London, and I'm looking to try and do one parallel to the North Circular as well. We're also going to study. We're doing three or four other big strands of work. We're studying a lorry ban. Studying a ban on lorries that don't have the requisite cycle safety equipment fitted. That is not something entirely within our power, as the cycle vision made clear, but we're studying to see how it can be achieved and who we need to persuade to get it done. We're doing a review of school cycle training. We spend quite a lot on school cycle training, but the number of kids cycling to school has fallen, so we're working out what needs to change there. We're doing a trial of electric bikes with the Metropolitan Police and a high-profile company, and a trial of public hire electric bikes. That is, by the way, the number two thing which the media has been interested in after the Westway and the Crossrail. sign of the kind of, you know, thirst for novelty. There's a whole load of other things. You can read them in the vision, what we're doing, but those are the main strands of work. There are six, I think, broad work streams for the infrastructure bits. There's the grid, there's the quiet way, the bike crossrail, the other superhighways, the mini Hollands in the suburbs, and then the rail superhubs and other rail-related work. And we're setting up separate teams for each of those work streams. And in fact, TfL's coming to me on Thursday to present to me its proposals for implementing those work streams, and then we'll go away and discuss them and see if I'm happy with them. But I hope we should have them all agreed by the end of the month. What else? We've got some quick wins. I mentioned CS5. I mentioned junction improvements. We're going to choose our Outer London Mini Hollands this year. We're writing to the boroughs in the next week or 10 days. The Outer London boroughs have already held meetings with three or four of them. And we will choose them, I hope, by late summer or early autumn. I suppose the other thing that Rachel mentioned about Danny, and I'm very keen on, is data. We need to gather data to support the programme. We've got to do some demand analysis. I don't want us to be paralysed by that. My view is that if we build it, they will come. The main analysis we are going to be doing is traffic and network impacts, and the main data we need will be kind of persuade the stakeholders type data. In macro terms, you know, look how big cycling is already type thing, the sort of thing that Danny's been doing about screen line counts on bridges. We are going to do a bike census in the next few weeks to show just how big cycling already is in central and inner London, to augment the existing counts we do at the screen line, which is the circle drawn round roughly the edge of central London and along the bridges. We're going to do some more counts. And the idea is, if council X says, "I'm sorry, we can't possibly put a bike lane along street Y," we can say, "Look, bikes are already 33% of the traffic on that street. Certainly, bring 33% of your attention." So that's the idea of that. Then there's kind of going to be narrow, the sort of micro type data for the hundreds of small granular arguments we will need to have with stakeholders, mostly councils. And again, that is also being gathered. But on data, that's the other area where you can help us. London, this is a huge city, there's a huge amount going on. We can't know everything that's going on in a city the size of London. The stuff, you know, that we won't know about. Even in TfL, there's probably stuff going on that we don't know about. I've got 3,000 people in the TfL service division alone. It's a gigantic organisation occupying a 14-storey office block. You can alert us to stuff that's going on that I might not know about. Stuff, obscure stuff buried in some kind of council minutes or, you know, that's one of the most important things that Danny and other bloggers have done, to be honest, is they've alerted us to various bits of crap that are going on that we need to know about and that otherwise would have happened if I hadn't known about them. Give you an example, the Haygate Estate near Eltham Castle is being redeveloped, as you know, and a group of people from Southwark Cyclists approached me via a Green member of the London Assembly, actually, to object that the facilities for cyclists in that estate, which is going to be the centre of two of our cycle routes, were really not good in the plan. And I had a look at it, and you know, they were right, and it wasn't good. And luckily, they approached me literally 8 days, 9 days before it was going to go for what we call stage two approval. The mayor has to approve all big policy schemes, all big planning schemes, of which the Haygate is one. And that gives us significant power, and we're going to use that power in future to make sure, as we have not done in the past, but we will do in the future, to make sure that all new planning schemes are cycle friendly. And as it happened, the Haygate was due to get its stage two planning approval 8 or 9 days after those guys approached me. I went down, I had a look at it, I talked to them, I agreed with them. I didn't think it was anything like good enough. So we just had time to go to the developer and say, look, unless you change it, we're not going to give you stage two. and they were only too keen to change it, as you can imagine. With the, you know, they thought they'd sealed the deal, and then suddenly along comes the mayor's office and says, no, we need to make this better for cyclists. And as a result, it is very substantially better now for cycles. They have completely redrawn the cycling routes to make it a lot more permeable. So when that scheme is eventually built, and it will, you know, it'll be built, frankly, long after Boris has left office. Most of it's not going to be built for another 6 or 7 years. That's how long the lag is. But when that scheme is finally built, it will not be another Olympic Park. It will be a good scheme for cyclists. But I needed to know about that. I didn't know about it off my own bat. And you know, obviously, one of the things I am going to do is I'm going to look through all these sorts of schemes and see what I think of them. But equally, if I'd waited to do that off my own bat, we would have lost that scheme, and it would have been given planning approval as it was, which wasn't good enough. And so I need to know. If you think there's something that's not good enough, I need to know. That's one of the most important things that the blogging community has done. Is they've been campaigners, and I pay tribute as well, like Rachel, to the work that Danny and the LCC and others have done. But they've also been intelligence gatherers, and that's incredibly useful for us, and it's incredibly useful for me. I have a small team working with me directly, and then I have obviously the vast 3,000 people at TFL. It would be incredibly helpful if I could have all of you as well, just alerting me to stuff that's no good. That is it, basically, from my point of view. I mean, throw any questions you like at me. I'm really quite pleased with how everything's gone so far. I've had really very good discussions with everybody I need to have discussions with. I haven't encountered much resistance at all to anything we want to do, either in TFL or the boroughs. But of course, it gets more difficult from now on in. So anyway, your question's very welcome.
Before we do, would you mind if I ask my very own question just for once? And that is actually about something you mentioned just now, Andrew, which was considering a lorry ban unless they have safety provision fitted. Obviously, it's a fairly topical subject today, of all days. Is that it?
The lorry ban, what we've said is we're going to study it. And we've got to study all sorts of things. Firstly, if you ban lorries of a particular size, if you ban one lorry of a particular size, does that just mean 10 lorries, smaller lorries, come in? What is the impact on business? What are people doing at the moment? Those are the kind of things we've got to study. So that's why we said it's a study. And also what our own legal powers are. We haven't got the legal power to ban lorries from London. There are some very convoluted ways we could do it, but it would certainly be subject to legal challenge. We probably need to get some legislation out of government. One of the things we're doing is we're drawing up a list of legislative wants from government, and this is probably going to be a moment.
Okay, let's open it up. I'm going to go right to the back.
What is your relationship with the Boris Park scheme, and when will that scheme be extended throughout?
It's in the metro today, it's been extended.
It will never be extended throughout London. It's only suitable for areas where it's not suitable for the suburbs, because there are not enough kind of suburban journeys tend to be. Tend to be kind of dispersal journeys. There's not a wide mesh of journeys, sort of a matrix of journeys. They tend to be from town centres to people's houses, or town centres to smaller places. And a cycle hire scheme like Boris Bikes would not work in those circumstances. We're looking at alternative forms of cycle hire in the suburbs. On the expansion, generally the policy is for incremental expansion. The fact is the Boris Bikes have taken up an enormous amount of our cycling budget in the last few years, and I want the proportion they take up to reduce. They will still take up a fair old proportion of the budget, I don't envisage any mass extension across the whole of London. I envisage incremental extensions of the footprint, maybe a mile here, a mile there. Isabel Dedwin, the Deputy Mayor for Transport, has referred to it oozing out across London. That's probably a good way of describing it. But everywhere I go, I get requests from boroughs to extend it to.
Katie and Martin over there.
Thanks, Martin, you're pretty something. And as you know, the lorry ban is something to do with the vision. Are you looking at the experience of Paris and Dublin?
Yeah, that's one of the things we're going to study. And the study is starting soon. Again, this is one of the things they're going to bring to me on Thursday. It's their proposal for the study. And the terms of it, who's going to do it, how long it's going to take. Yeah, I mean, a whole range of options will be studied. Banning lorries above a certain size, banning lorries that don't have the right equipment, banning lorries at certain times of day. But we're not committing to any of those options. This is a study. Okay.
Okay. Wow, this is quite challenging. Should we go here?
Oh, yeah, hi. I literally came back from Holland this afternoon.
Right. Never cycle in Holland, it just spoils you, it makes
no helmet. People of all ages, all sizes, all girls, leisure cycling on roads that are segregated. Lots of things to say very quickly though. I cycled in London back in the 70s when I was very young, and there were infinitely more people cycling then than there are now.
Infinitely what?
More people cycling then than there are now.
Okay.
In the 70s.
Right.
It changed in the 80s.
Right.
Default speed limit. It's very nice that boroughs have been given the opportunity to have 20 if they want it. You wouldn't say to Lancashire they can have 70 mile an hour on the motorway and Yorkshire you can have 80 mile on the motorway. It has to be a default speed limit, otherwise no one will take any notice. It was on 5 Live the other day, policemen said they won't take any notice. The Western congestion charge, as soon as that went, Chiswick, which is a key borough, because when we had the flyover, the problem with the flyover, Chiswick was gridlock, and then Hammersmith was gridlock, and everywhere's gridlock. Got to be looked at stopping people from coming. Can we stop the amnesty of parking at the weekends and on holidays?
I think you're on three questions.
On cyclists and pedestrians and bus users. And the last one about lorries, though, is currently, and I'm not sure on my geography because I don't cycle into town very often, St Thomas's Hospital, I think, there's a bus lane which says bikes, taxis, buses, motorbikes, and lorries. Over 7.5 tonnes. Can you tell me how I meant to cycle in
I don't know about that one, I'm sorry.
And also, non-commuting cyclists, we're the ones who cycle slowly and need speed.
I know. Yeah, on 20 miles an hour, as the document says, the vision says, we are going to do more 20 mile an hour limits. We're doing them at Camberwell, we're doing them at New Cross. We're doing them in two places at Waterloo on TLRN roads, and we support any borough that wants to do them on its own roads, and several boroughs have gone for kind of blanket 20 mile an hour limits. So we are happy to consider 20 mile an hour limits on a case by case basis. That said, I don't think we can say that the default on the TLRN, Transport for London Route Network, 5% of our roads, the biggest and busiest roads in London, I don't think we can say that the default speed limit will be 20 miles an hour, because there will be some roads, the North Circular for instance, where that's probably not appropriate, and where it would in any case be politically, I think, quite difficult. Very few cyclists use the North Circular. Our roads have to perform a number of functions. They do have to provide essential radial transport and orbital transport for goods and services. But wherever we can, we will look sympathetically at requests for 20 mile an hour limits. And I don't envisage the 4 we're already doing to be the limit. What else was the other question was what? Remind me again, sorry.
Oh, Western congestion charge.
The Western extension zone probably, it didn't do very much to reduce traffic. That was the most interesting thing about it, unlike the central zone. I looked at this quite closely, and it didn't reduce traffic very much inside the Western extension, and it also increased it on the borders. It increased it considerably in Hammersmith and Fulham, which was, obviously that's a little bit further east than Chiswick, but one of the most interesting things about the Western Extension Zone, one of the reasons why Boris got rid of it, was that it didn't really do what it said on the tin.
I'm just going to jump in with one more question which relates slightly to that. You talked earlier about the London Cycle Design Standards and how important they are, and I think we'd all agree on that. But one thing that I find TfL actually is slightly confused about in its own mind is it designs wonderful cycling scheme, and then along comes traffic lights, and they go, traffic flow problem. And time and again at the moment, you find that cycling is kind of battered down the priority list in order to get your goods and services moving around. How do you deal with that? Because that seems to be a real conflict.
Part of the problem has been in the past that TfL's traffic modelling systems don't take adequate account of cyclists, as they concede, as is widely agreed. And they are redesigning them to take better account of cyclists. And that's something I'm working with them on. Some of the time it will be we just take the hit. I mean, the traffic flow impact of CS2, the extension to CS2, isn't particularly good, to be honest. As has already been reported, there are negative traffic flow impacts of that. We just decided to take the hit on that, to be honest, because we think it's important. And I haven't yet, and maybe it's, you know, maybe yet being the operative word, but I haven't yet had that kind of pushback from TfL on any of the kind of schemes we're talking about. Some of which will actually take quite significant amounts of road space away from motor traffic.
John, and then I'll come back over to this side.
Yeah, thanks. I've got a point actually which follows on from this, and it is to do with data collection. A lot of the time, when there are major roadworks that are going on within the boroughs, I'm sort of seeing missed opportunities in terms of data collection to illustrate traffic evaporation.
I agree.
And because some of the officers, I mean, I'm from Wandsworth, and some of the officers there are still believing the Department of Transport's forecast that there's going to be growth of cars. How can we get the boroughs to, when there are roadworks, to do counts before, during, after?
We're going to do it. You're from Wandsworth. I've been talking to Wandsworth about what happened when the Albert Bridge closed. There isn't particularly good data, but it didn't seem to cause a kind of massive traffic chaos that had been predicted. The shops along Albert Bridge Road complained bitterly about loss in the bars and things, complained bitterly about loss of traffic, loss of business. But in traffic terms, there wasn't really the kind of massive congestion on Battersea Bridge that some people have been expecting. And we've seen some really interesting effects from the Olympics as well. I was just in Newham this morning actually talking about their plans for cycling. And one of the things that they said is that since the Olympic route network restrictions came in Newham, the traffic fell off a cliff. It fell by 15 to 20% in Stratford, for instance. In Stratford High Street, we're putting CS2 exit. And it hasn't come back. It didn't come back after the Olympics ended. And from that, they and I surmised that people switched to public transport, or rather modes, for their journeys, and they found out it wasn't as bad as they thought it would be, and they decided to stay with it. And so, basically, what we're going to do is we're going to collect data. Sometimes the boroughs will, sometimes they won't, so just to make sure it's collected, we're going to collect it. There's another interesting case. Hammersmith Bridge was closed for ages, and again, did that cause a kind of traffic chaos that everyone predicted? I don't know, but I know less about that case because it was a while back. But that's the kind of thing we want to do.
Would there be a point that we could let you know? Because that would be to flag up schemes.
Yeah, very much. Flag up. I mean, you know, there's been some big, as you know, roadworks on Farringdon Road. That's a road of interest to us. Actually, we're thinking about doing something on there. And we're very interested indeed in the data of the effect that those works have had on the traffic. And whether it, you know, really did, the area did seize up. One of the most important things I'm doing, one of the most important sentences in the vision, actually, is the sentence saying that we will trial temporary interventions on the roads. One of the problems with the TfL approach in the past has been that they love their kind of earthworks, and they love their kind of, you know, really big sculpted roadworks. And you see the Blackfriars thing, and it's like it's got, you know, a sort of little lawn in the middle of the road there. It's kind of all landscapes. And they build it. They do these things. They plan them very heavily. Then they build them
quite expensively and quite time consumingly, and in a very kind of permanent, solid way, that's very difficult to change if it doesn't work. And so what I want to do, and I think what they're up for, having learned from the experience of the Olympic Route Network, is just trial stuff with like orange plastic on the roads and see if it works. And, you know, I say to them, right, let's do this at, you know, Lambeth Roundabout, take a totally hypothetical example. And they say, no, we can't do that, the traffic will tail back to, you know, Clapham Junction or something. Well, I say, let's just try it and see with the orange plastic and see what happens. And if the traffic does tail back to Clapham Junction, we can take it away again. But, you know, it might be we try it and we find actually that everyone, you know, adjusts, as they often seem to for big roadworks. So that's basically a key thing in the vision, and they do get that, I think.
That's almost scary common sense. There's a whole cluster of people here. I'll go to you first and then we'll work our way around.
I'm Martin from the Cambridge Cycling Campaign. The first thing I think is that I want to say is, you know, the country is looking to you and what's happening in London. You know, we want to see the same kind of things, and this is our newsletter this month, London to reallocate road space, you know. The two things that we really face in terms of getting really good Dutch quality infrastructure where I live, and I think it's the same across London, are one, removing car parking. Mm-hmm. From key routes, you know the problem on the two highways, you know.
Yeah.
And secondly, a priority over side roads. The idea that instead of this traditional shared use approach, you come to a side road, give way, look in the right direction to cross over.
Yeah.
What can you do to reassure us about those two things, car parking and priority over side roads, in terms of
side
quality roads infrastructure?
Is a really, I happened to be in Oxford yesterday, and there's a genuinely atrocious cycle lane in Oxford. I don't know if anyone knows Oxford. It's like, you know where Keble College is? And there's a kind of, I can't remember the name of the road, but there's a sort of, there's a cycle lane along the road. And in order to stop people, the stop line for the traffic joining from side streets, it's not set back by the cycle lane. No, it's in the normal place, right by where it joins the road. And so what they've done, they've erected barriers on the cycle lane to stop you. So not just the normal kind of foxy give way signs, they've actually erected physical metal barriers to stop you. So it's that you can't cycle on the cycle road. It's literally impossible to cycle on. We see that, for instance, in some of our existing routes, CS3 along the A13. Anyone who goes east of Canning Town will find that you basically have to cross all the side streets as if you're a pedestrian, kind of weave in and out. Well, that's total rubbish. I mean, we're going to change that, and that's going to be part of the London Cycle Design Standards.
Car parking
is a much more tricky one, to be honest. To be absolutely honest with you, it's an electric rail for a lot of the Tory councils we deal with, and ultimately it's their call. We can't force them to remove parking, but I hope to try to persuade them to.
Touchy. Should we go here?
Yes, a point about the feedback you get, and you said how important it is. Do you think, and because probably there's more expertise with bloggers, with the LCC, people like Rachel, than inside the TfL, and do you plan to sort of formalize a way that you can gather fruit from this expertise, rather than sort of reading some tweets here and there, or somebody catching you 8 days before? Would it be better to have a sort of an approach, a lightweight consultation, so that when you speak to idiots like Martin Law, you have some...
Generally, I mean, that's absolutely right. I mean, I'm glad David Arditi is here, because I've got a meeting with Brent tomorrow. I'm going to speak to him about Brent. We're thinking about setting up something called a cycling sounding board, on which the trouble is, you know, who do you pick? I can see that being problematic, and I can see people being kind of annoyed that they're not in it, and I can see other people, you know. That is my slight problem with it, but we're thinking about doing it as a formal way. On the whole, I have found, I found lots of people to be enormously helpful in doing this, and I've tended to talk to them I talk quite widely to people. That's a huge part of my job, and I tend to do it kind of in one-to-one or in small groups.
I'm going to ask a quick question, if I may. Do you not think the ambition for cycling is still fairly flimsy? It's only 5% that we're aiming at in, what, 10 years? And that's not exactly Dutch quality 20% of people bumbling around on bikes, is it?
We looked, I knew LCC wanted a 5% modal share by 2020 and 10% by 2026. And I really did crunch the numbers very heavily on this. Mm. And I came to the conclusion it's just completely impossible. We can't promise things that we cannot do. At least I don't want to promise things we cannot do. I mean, let me go through the numbers here. At the moment, there are 26.5 million journeys made in London every day, of which 500,000, that is just under 2%, are by bike. And even if the number of journeys made by other modes did not increase at all over the next 7 years, highly unlikely event given that we're getting Crossrail and obviously population growth and all the rest of it, but even if the number of journeys by other modes did not increase at all, that would mean that in order to get a 5% mode share by 2020, we would need to get 1.275 million journeys by bike in 7 years. We need to go up from 500,000 to 1.275 million. And that would require growth of around, depending on where you take the base, of around 19% a year in the number of journeys, which is growth, that is a level of growth over a period, a sustained period, that has never been seen anywhere in the world. Some places have managed 19% in odd years. We managed 15% on the TLRN roads in 1 year ourselves. But nobody's ever managed it for anything like as long as 7 years each year. And we'd have to do that. In the last, just to give you an example of the kind of, to put that in perspective, for the last 10 years we've averaged about 7.7% a year. So I can't promise things we can't do, basically. I have really crunched the numbers and I don't think it's possible.
Okay, let's come here.
I'm Graham Smith. I'm a CTC councillor for the South East, and I was very interested in what you were saying about planning in this 1-6 and new schemes, and enormously excited by the new projects. But one of the things that has worried me for, or concerned me for many years, is that major resurfacing, or the annual budget of highway authorities. In Oxfordshire, I think it's £17 million a year. Mm. I think I commented on about £600,000 worth, and that's £17 million. Yeah. And not all of it, of course, will be relevant, but if I look at somewhere like Copenhagen, I can see that 20 or 25 years ago there was paint on the ground, and I was surprised to see cars stuck 2 metres from the curb, and I go back 5 years ago and I discovered that all those lanes have been built up. Yeah. I speak to the man who spoke a few months ago here in London, and he said on the phone to Copenhagen, he said, oh yes, the bit you're talking about, we're going to do that next week, and we're going to do the next bit. So the kind of incremental process is enormously important, and possibly throws everything else into...
A lot of this is not about kind of big flashy schemes. We have got some, partly because drive the perception change I talked about. But a lot of it's about small, granular things. Little changes, a drop curve here, some signposting there, that kind of thing. One of the other things I like, particularly like about the vision, I like all of it because I wrote it, one of the things I particularly like is the emphasis on kind of lo-fi schemes. We're sometimes compared to New York. Obviously New York, central New York streets are completely different from our own. They are generally one way, they are very wide. There isn't the same room for bicycle lanes in London's streets as there are in most of New York's. But one of the things I think we can copy from New York is the kind of lo-fi way they've done it. I don't know if anyone's been there. I went there, cycled around in September, not at public expense, I might say. I like the way they've done it. They've just done it with like planters and parked cars and little kind of plastic wands that you can drive over and sort of flip down when you drive over, but nobody does because they think they're made of metal.
Could I follow up? Because it's not quite the angle I was thinking of. I've discovered that One road in Oxford was being resurfaced. We discovered about the project because it was in the local newspaper to start in 3 weeks' time.
You mean surfacing, do you?
We actually produced a scheme by hook or by crook quite quickly. Walked the street with transport plans and admitted that many of the things, everything could have been done. We're finally told, even if we agreed with what you say, which we don't, which is a good cover up, we haven't got time to think or any funds to do. So what happens is that somebody makes a decision about the cost of a resurfacement. It might take 5 or 10 years to get to the top of the funding bar.
Yeah.
And the decision that's made is never revisited, or only in a very minor
this
way.
This is what I meant when I talked about the tanker being slow to turn. I mean, there's something about this country that makes these kind of projects too slow and bureaucratic. We do have, TfL actually does have a lot more money for the roads overall than it did. And a lot of that money is going to be spent on servicing. And there's going to be particular priority for roads where cycle stuff is being put in. Because the surfacing on a lot of the roads is atrocious at the moment. It's particularly bad at this time of year, of course. I mean, not just TfL roads, but borough roads need to pay more attention to surfacing. But the process is I'd say slower here than in Copenhagen, and I haven't yet bottomed out why that is, I'm afraid. I've only been in the job for 2 months, two and a bit months. But
you know. So very quickly, New York, lots and lots of police on the streets, and a default speed limit that's really slow. I was cycling there on Christmas as well.
I felt rather scared cycling New York, and I felt the traffic went rather fast. When there's not traffic jams, it tends to bomb right along.
We'll go here because that hand's been up several times.
John Hayes from Saxon. When you asked us to let you know what's going on because you don't know what's going on
How do you do that?
We'd be delighted to assist.
Yeah.
We find TfL really very, very difficult to communicate with.
Okay, well, don't communicate with them, communicate with me. And I would be very interested to hear about any scheme that. It's not good enough. Try and manage the flow of information to me, though. Okay.
You heard it.
One of the things I want to try and do is create some kind of better mechanism where people can get through to TfL. But it's one of the many things I've still got to do, and we just haven't got to.
We're going to switch from the dark side of the room. I don't know why you don't have any lighting for a minute. Just over here, there are like hundreds of hands. This job is quite hard work. We'll go for this chap here in the purple tie.
Thank you. My name is Eric, and I'm a dad of three little children.
Thank you for raising the dress standards.
They're literally every morning packed into my old Volvo and shipped to the school. When is that going to change for millions of children?
Yeah, I'm really interested in this. In fact, we were talking about it just this afternoon. I had the bikeability guy in this afternoon. And one of the things we're going to do is what we're calling cycle school partnerships. And that will allow schools to devise their own cycling routes. And I'm going to see, in fact, a group of schools in Tufnell Park which have already devised such a route. And A lot of the time it's about confidence. The key is we spend quite a lot of money on cycle training, as I mentioned, and yet the proportion of kids cycling school in London has fallen, even as the proportion of adult cycling has risen, and even as the proportion of kids cycling to school elsewhere in the country has also risen. And we were talking about this with the bikeability guy this afternoon, and the key driver, both he and I agreed, is parental fear and parental unwillingness to let their children cycle. And we're having a review of cycle to school training. We're thinking about doing it at a slightly older age.
Excuse me, I just interject. It's not about letting the children cycle, it's about them being there on their own. It's more about security of the children, not about the children cycling.
Took the words right out of my mouth, sir.
If the housewife got on the bike and cycled with them, it would work.
Yeah. I was about to say that this has to be thought about. One of the problems I think is that it's typically done at the age of 10 or 11. And that's an age where parents are not necessarily happy about letting their children out on their own for anything, let alone for cycling. And so we have to tackle two separately related issues, which are parents think the cycling's too dangerous generally, and parents don't want to let their kids out at all at the age of 10 or 11. So the answer might be to move the training, for instance, to secondary school and to move it to 13 or 14, when parents are happier to let their kids out on the roads and out of their sight. Part of the answer. Go on.
I'm sorry, I've been through all this. We've done slight safe routes to school. We did it 3 years ago.
Yeah.
We had project safe routes to school. Every London borough did it. We did it. I live in Chiswick. The reason people won't do it is not because they're frightened, actually, of the kids being nicked. They can't get to school. The parents are going to work, however they get to work. The kids can't even get to the school on a bike if they've not learned to ride. You can take them to primary school. The take-up was very small. I've always cycled with my child.
Yeah.
Because I'm like that. Yeah, he was on the back of my bike. He was alongside me. It's too dangerous to get them there. The speed limit's too much. You've got too many cars on the road. You've got too many lorries on the road. You have got to start with mums. I'm sorry, it is mums generally taking the kids to school, because that's the school run. And you get them out the car and onto a bike with the children.
It's a little pushed around.
I'm sorry.
Can I just add one more thing here? I work a lot with lots of children, because I'm a coach also with children. And you'll be surprised these days how many young children are very confident cyclists, actually.
Yeah.
But the real trouble is that there aren't, you know, safer roads.
Exactly.
Given it's just about half a mile away, that people are shipped, and it's a shame that people are shipped in the cars just for half a mile.
Sure. Now, I agree with every word of that, and as you can read in the vision, I think it says, in fact, these are the words it says. I'll find it for you. It says, training will work best where it's combined with route improvements which give parents the confidence to allow their children on the roads. So that's absolutely our approach.
Pushing it to 13 or 14, one of the problems is the transition to secondary school is the key moment for people. The behaviour change, all the examples of behaviour change are that you have to, where people make life changes, it's most effective. That's a big life change.
It's not working at the moment, that's the problem. That's my problem.
If you look at what Hackney are about to introduce in the next event here, I think, but the Hackney are going to do individualised maps for each and secondary school to go to each turning year seven children. And that's the way they're focusing on.
The Tufnell Park scheme involves a 2 mile circular route, which is actually on side streets. A lot of schools can be reached without needing to use main roads. And a lot of it's going to be about giving the parents the confidence to let their kids use that route. And also about things like banning parking near the school, so you can't do the school run in a car. No, I haven't. I'm afraid. Because of the disagreements about approaching this area, like the vision said, we are having a review into this whole area, and we'll announce that, and everybody will be able to contribute. But I mean, when I was a kid, I cycled to school. I grew up in West London, suburban West London. I lived in Teddington. I went to school in Ham, a place called Greycourt, and there were 180 bike stands at that school, enough for about a quarter of the kids, and they were all full every morning. And I bet if I went back there now, they wouldn't be.
Let's go back to questions rather than dialogue from Annette. Shall we have one from Caroline?
I just wanted to pick up again on this getting kids cycling to school. One thing you should be doing is getting parents doing the cycle training with the kids.
Yeah, that's something else that we were literally... Erica can vouch for this. This is precisely what we're talking about this afternoon.
Yeah, I mean, it's the only way, because that way, because actually you've got to train us parents to feel confident cycling with our kids on a road.
Yeah.
And it's really scary cycling on busy roads with kids.
Yeah.
And so unless you get the parents, you get all of us in this room doing that cycle training with our kids, it's not going to happen. And do it at primary school, because they've got to get in the habit of it. Once they go to secondary school, it's a whole culture of going to school on the bus. So they just won't do it. And they get free bus passes. So
All of this is going to be in the view, okay?
It's really interesting though, isn't it? Because in the whole kind of cycling upswell, the cycling to school thing is not there in the media attention, it's not there in the blogging attention, and yet the one thing that's reverberating around this room very strongly is this one topic.
It's really important, because otherwise we get a new generation growing up that's a stranger.
Yep, right, let's go right to the back. I don't know who you are, but I'm going over your... Over your.
I think sometimes it's relatively true that they're very cycling itself as children in school, it seems kind of normal thing to do. You actually look at kind of more the health benefits and so on, health problems, in terms of getting middle aged and older people. Exactly. I'm not saying it's an but you know, there is an argument actually not the best place to start. You'd actually get better benefits from starting people 50 to 60 this cycling, because they're the ones having heart attacks. But if I may start with a very quick point, question. In terms of what you said about evaluation, I think that's really important. I may just ask that there's a real openness in the evaluation. I'm checking with the educators. And if we could have evaluation, see what's happened, you can potentially get academics to come in and give their expertise to it, and the TfL can develop your culture, which reports are made available, the data is made available, and ideally even the models are made available. And I think there's a lot of skills out there from the bloggers, the academic community, and people can contribute to that.
Yeah.
And that hasn't always been my experience of the way to work.
I know that it's a failing of large bureaucracies to be like that. But yeah, I totally agree with you.
Can we have a genuine question this time rather than a general statement? We'll go to this woman at the back.
It's sort of linked, but it is a genuine question. I'm really interested in what the needs assessment process was for building a vision. So you talked about how it was very much, it's a vision for people who aren't cycling yet. Can you tell us a bit about how you learnt about what those people who aren't cycling yet want and need?
TfL's done quite a lot of research about, they did a report called Analysis of Cycling Potential, which forms the basis of some of these policies. We've also done a fair amount of market research about why people don't cycle, and who are cyclists and who are the quote near market groups in TfL speak. So we know quite a lot about that, but my concern is that if we spent a huge amount of time kind of trying to trying to sort of gather data, formulate policies, we never actually get to the policies. I think we need to sort of lay down some policies, and my approach is very much if we build it, they will come. And we've seen that in a lot of other schemes. I mean, the initial cycle superhighways, for instance, CS3 and CS7, CS7 particularly, really not very good. But actually, quite a lot of people used it, and there was a big increase in cycling along it, even though it's, for most of its length, it's not much more than blue paint on the road. And that suggests that there is a big appetite for what we build. And I'm hoping that if we build it properly, then we'll get even more uptake. But there's a danger, I do think, of over-analysing stuff. We've only got 3 years. He's only got 3 years left in office. If we spent a year analysing, where the precise market segments we should target were, then worked out policies to target them, we'd only have 2 years to do the policies and we wouldn't get them done.
I think we've got time for about three more questions. There's a woman here behind. Yep.
Yeah, I see there's a bit of a Camden cluster there, you and Brian.
The vision refers to it, but you've not mentioned it very much this evening, about driver behaviour, enforcement, culpability, and working with the police. And I actually think that a lot more to be done in Ontario and experiences, since I've been knocked down 3 times by those cyclists in the ASL, the police needs to do anything about it, saying it's not safe. Public interest where they certainly find the resources to target cyclists going through red lights. And I think there's a lot of potential for actually targeting driver behaviour. Without that sort of backup for cycle facilities, then actually there still will be that fear of using the roads.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it's one of the areas we're doing. In fact, we need to talk to the police about cycling generally in all sorts of ways. And I have a meeting, in fact, another meeting with them on Wednesday about precisely that topic. And I mean, Eric and I were counting on the way over how many ASLs we passed had cars in them, and I'm afraid it was a rather large number. Nobody seems to take it terribly seriously. They're not enforced often, and I think we need to do something about that. Having said that, as a daily cyclist in London myself, I haven't found driver behaviour to be all that bad here. I mean, I think it's a lot.
Try cycling in some of the big towns outside London. Yeah. It is actually a lot better in London than it is in Liverpool, Manchester, Sheffield, Leeds, Birmingham.
I'm a great deal more scared as a cyclist out in the country when you have people kind of tearing past at 70 miles an hour around blind corners. And I think driver behaviour in London is not always as bad as it's cracked up.
Anyone on the dark side? Because I haven't been over here for a while.
Well, I've spoken a lot.
You've spoken a lot, so I'm going to go right to the back.
Who I am.
But actually, can I go right to the back?
I live very close to the UCS, Spartan Vision UCS 5. I know nothing about transport policy. I just know that what I'm sure they're doing. One of the biggest dangers for me that I experience, and I've heard it a few times from other people in the room, is car parking. And I felt that it's the one topic during this evening's discussion that you were a little bit dismissive of.
Well,
I know it's a very big issue, and I know that obviously, it's, as you say, it's the electric rail. You also mentioned that you're quite proud of this sentence, a trial in the vision.
Yeah.
And I think it sounds great, the effect of being able to do some things and not have great expense. In the consultation for CS5, there will be off-peak parking for Camberwell. Stick that in the trial. Take out the off-peak parking.
Okay. All right. I mean, on parking, look, I'm just trying to be honest with you here. I'm not going to promise things that we can't do. We depend on the cooperation with the boroughs to remove parking, and parking is, as I said, it's the third rail of London politics. Touch it and you die. And that goes for Labour boroughs.
Touch it and you literally die. I know.
But I mean, I love to remove parking, but it's ultimately not my call, it's the borough's call. And they will make the decision. And I want to try and incentivise them to do it. But at the same time, we've got to work with the grain here. We've got to try and get them to do things by starting out with things they'll be happy to do and then, working up to the harder things. And if I come in straight away and say, right, you're going to do this, this and this, and otherwise I'm not going to work with you, then they shut down totally. So you have to take it quite gradually. I agree with you about parking. I think it is not as important as it was actually in the overall scheme of things, simply because fewer people have cars. But nonetheless, you will find this in Labour and in Tory boroughs alike, almost, that any proposal to remove parking always generates enormous political heat and enormous resident anger. And it led to the downfall of the entire leadership of Westminster Council not so long ago. So they are particularly sensitive about it. So I can't promise that I'm going to come go in my hobnail boots and say, you will remove parking or else, because I'm not.
I'm just going to ask a question that was asked before the sent in before today, on behalf of someone in the audience. Paralympics, no real legacy whatsoever. Should there be? Will there be?
Well, I'm interested in the. I mean, one of the things about a lot of the routes we're going to try and make into quiet ways is that they are blocked with various barriers of various sorts. And they're not just infuriating for able-bodied cyclists. They are literally impossible to navigate, the cyclists with disabilities, a lot of them. And so one of the things we'll be doing is trying to remove as many barriers like that as possible. We're thinking about chicanes and that kind of thing. And I mean, there's a lot of them in some south of the river boroughs for some reason. That's one of the arguments I'm going to be using with them. And In the Netherlands, actually, people with disabilities are allowed to use the cycle lanes, even if they haven't got bicycles. You know, people with motorised wheelchairs and scooters and things like that. That might be an approach worth looking at. I can't commit to doing it, but it might be worth looking at.
Okay, we're going to go with two more questions, one from the right and one from the left, and this is going to be really hard because everyone's going to hate me, but David, I think you deserve a question.
Another simple question. What's the timescale for the Crossrail for the bike? And mini Hollands, how many will there be? And will they be big, like half a barrel or a quarter of a barrel? Roughly how big will they be?
They're going to be between 1 and 3 mini Hollands, we think. If the competition is particularly intense and they're all doing really good schemes, we might stretch to 4. The general scope will be the whole borough. Obviously, there'll be different emphases in different parts of the borough. But what I'm looking for is willingness for really quite radical transformation of the major town centre in that borough. I've spoken already to 3 outer London boroughs face to face about this who have expressed interest, and a number of others have expressed interest, and I'm seeing 2 others, I think, in the next couple of weeks, and obviously I'm sure they'll all apply, or most of them will apply. 1 or 2 probably won't, but yeah, that's basically what it's going to be on the crosswalk for the bike 2016.
All right, we're going over to this side of the room. Dominic?
So this is really about the parking thing. This isn't really a question. This is, for people who want to, you can reframe residents' parking, which is a subsidy to a subsidy to drivers, a subsidy to people who own cars. Because resident parking is incredibly cheap when storing a car on the street. It's like, you know, £100 a year.
Yeah.
You know, if you pay for commercial parking, you're paying like £1,000 to £2,000 a year. So really, it's money to people who own cars.
Right, since that wasn't actually a question, I'm now going to allow one more question, then I'm going to ask the room a question. I have no idea where I'm going to go. Mark, you've had loads of questions already. You've spoken already. You haven't, though.
Oh, hi. My name's Ray Whitehouse. I'm from Havering, which is beyond the end of all the cycle superhighways. And we have a much different problem than the rest of London in encouraging cycling and encouraging the borough to take up cycling initiatives. The question I'll ask you, because you've talked about how you're talking to all the inner London boroughs, zones 1 to 2, what are you going to do with the zone 6s as opposed to the ones in between? How are you going to approach the boroughs to encourage them to take part, I think is my question.
I hope Havering will want to be one of our mini Hollands.
So do I, by the way.
Yeah, we haven't heard from them yet, so I have to give them a bit of a prod. Not all the outer London boroughs, frankly, are interested in cycling. Some are actively hostile to it. And I just can't be bothered to work with anyone who doesn't want to work with me. We've got more than enough people who do want to work with me. Those who are interested, we will do. They will all benefit from the quiet ways. They'll all have quiet ways. The superhighway programme will, as I say, be redrawn. It will include more of outer London than it does now. The superhighways will look different from how they do now, and they will benefit from that as well. Every borough will also continue to get funding from TfL through the LIPS process, but one of the things I want to avoid is this kind of idea that you've got to kind of... I mean, I am in favour of, on the whole, of doing things sort of doing a smaller number of things really well, rather than kind of doing loads and loads of things completely inadequately. So I'm not going to do lots of painting pictures of bicycles on roads or anything like that. But if any borough wants to come to me with a good scheme, then my door is open.
Right, folks, I have a question for you lot, which is namely this. Nearly a year ago, about 10,000 of us, you, I don't know if you're all here, cycled along, making a bit of a point that we wanted things to change on cycling in London. And for my own personal interest, I'd be interested to gauge the room, actually, of hands up, and I think 3 options. One is things are looking up, one's things are looking roughly the same, and one's things are looking worse. So can we start with worse? Who think things are getting worse? No one. About the same? 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and better. Fairly overwhelming. So that's really, really useful to know. Thank you. I think we're going to wrap up now. My voice is about to wrap up as well. I hope you've enjoyed it. I hope I've managed to get across all of your questions. If I haven't, I'm very sorry. And thank you very much for coming.